EcoReport is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
EcoReport is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Good morning, and welcome to EcoReport. For WFHB, I'm Juliana Daly.
And I'm David Lyman. Lake Monroe's oldest bald eagle was spotted late last month. The 29-year-old bird is one of the original 73 bald eagles brought to Indiana in the 1980s. Assistant non-game bird biologist for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Amy Kearns, says the eagles were brought from Alaska to Indiana in hopes of restoring the bald eagle nesting population.
In 1985, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Division of Fish and Wildlife began a bald eagle reintroduction project where we released 73 eagles into the wild and hoped that they would come back and form the base of a nesting population in Indiana. And the plan worked. They came back and started nesting again at Lake Monroe in 1991. And this year, we have an estimated 300 nesting pairs in the state.
Professional photographer Stuart Forsyth was able to capture images of the eagle in the Middle Fork Wildlife on June 24th. Researchers were able to identify her by the distinctive red leg band labeled C43.
One of her leg bands says C43, and that's how we're able to identify her as that individual. She was released in 1988 at Lake Monroe and wandered around, went to Kentucky and Tennessee until she was an adult. Then we found her nesting at Lake Monroe, and she might still be nesting there this year, even at 29 years old.
The restoration program is one of many programs dedicated to protecting endangered and threatened species in Indiana. It is the first endangered species restoration project initiated by the Department of Natural Resources non-game wildlife staff.
In other local news, April 19th saw the passing of a city ordinance in Bloomington prohibiting the use of electronic smoking devices in public places. To inform the public, the city is offering window clings to businesses that want to keep people from using vaporizers and e-cigarettes in their facilities. The city's health projects coordinator, Nancy Woolery, hopes the new signs will increase public knowledge of the ordinance.
We want everyone to know that right now there is no vaping as well as no tobacco smoking in all public buildings and places of employment. And that's why we need to get the word out. And we do have the window clings if businesses would like those, which specifically do say no smoking, no vaping. And that way when somebody does vape, and now that it's a law that they cannot, the managers will have a little more control over saying, no, this is illegal. We have a passed ordinance now, and I mean, they can point to the sign.
Although vapes and e-cigarettes are pushed as healthier alternatives to cigarettes, Woolery claims otherwise.
There's not a lot of research on them, but research is finding that there are a lot of different solutions in the vapor that can cause a lot of harm to folks who smoke them and those around them. So there's different chemicals that they put into each one. So it's hard really to know what you are using. And again, they are not regulated.
According to a press release from the city, the aerosol that electronic smoking devices emit can contain carcinogens and toxins like formaldehyde, nickel, isoprene, and lead.
Finally, also in Bloomington, The Indiana Daily Student and the Wall Street Journal report that IU spent almost $650,000 recently to inspect two dorms for mold in the heating units and to remediate the problem by cleaning and re-insulating the units. Inspectors found mold first at Teeter Quadrangle and later at McNutt Quadrangle. The remediation efforts are taking months. Students living in the dorms have reported respiratory problems and insist that the university should have addressed the issue much earlier. Some students have had to move out of their dorms temporarily. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, mold is omnipresent in the air and many surfaces and grows in damp areas. Some people are more sensitive to it than others. For those who are sensitive, exposure to mold can cause nasal stuffiness, throat irritation, coughing or wheezing, or eye or skin irritation. People with mold allergies can develop more severe reactions. Immune-compromised people and those with chronic lung illness can develop serious lung infections when exposed to mold.
In today's Nature News, the fate of Karner's blue butterfly. A few years ago, Indiana was home to a distinctive butterfly, the Karner's blue butterfly. Karner's blues are small butterflies about the size of a nickel. Female Karner's blues only lay eggs on or near lupine plants, and young Karner's blue caterpillars, which are small, green, and soft bodies, feed only on wild or blue lupine leaves and flowers. The caterpillars also have a mutual relationship with mound-building ants, which protect the caterpillars from predators and parasites. In exchange, the caterpillars excrete a sugary substance, which is consumed by the ants. After a few weeks of feeding, Karner blue caterpillars form a chrysalis. Adults emerge in about 10 days. Two generations of Karner's blues are produced every year. The first hatch occurs from mid-May through early June. These butterflies lay eggs, which hatch and become adults for a second hatch from mid-July through early August. Years ago, Karner's blue butterflies could be found flitting around at the Indiana Dunes State Park. But when the climate warmed too much for lupine to flourish in Indiana, the species was starved out. Today, there are no Karner's blues in Indiana. However, surveys completed by the Michigan Natural Features Inventory indicated that the butterflies are currently present in at least 10 southern Michigan counties: Allegan, Eona, Kent Lake, Mason, Muskota, Montcalm, Muskegon, Newaygo, and Oceana. Karner's blues habitat has shifted northward, a change that is unlikely to be reversed anytime soon.
Now from the national news. Scott Pruitt, the EPA chief newly appointed by President Trump, reversed the agency's ban on Dow Chemical's pesticide, chlorpyrifos, 2 days after meeting privately with Dow's CEO. Studies have shown that the popular pesticide can interfere with brain development in fetuses and infants and is detrimental to pregnant women. EPA's own scientists pointed out that chlorpyrifos, when sprayed on crops, can cause adverse health effects even if ingested in minute amounts. Dow spent over $13 million on lobbying last year. The company donated $1 million to help pay for Trump's inaugural celebration. According to the Associated Press, Dow is lobbying the Trump administration to ignore the findings of federal scientists that organophosphate pesticides, including chlorpyrifos, can harm about 800 critically threatened or endangered species. In early May, chlorpyrifos, sprayed on a California orchard, drifted into a neighboring cabbage field and caused illness in a dozen farm workers, one of whom had to be hospitalized.
Another pesticide has been in the headlines recently. On June 23rd, the Arkansas State Plant Board decided to ban the spraying of the herbicide dicamba on extended, genetically engineered soybeans and cotton. For the ban to go into effect, it must be approved by the governor and a state legislative committee. Dicamba is a product of Monsanto, which has come under fire for generally engineering herbicide-resistant soybeans and cotton that allow large quantities of herbicide to be sprayed on them. The U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the use of dicamba and Monsanto's other popular herbicide, glyphosate, with the brand name Roundup. Dicamba is subject to drift onto crops other than the ones it sprayed on. The problem has been reported in Tennessee and Missouri, as well as Arkansas, during the last two growing seasons. Dicamba is toxic to broadleaf plants such as fruit, nuts, vegetables, soybeans, and soybeans that haven't been genetically engineered. Critics of dicamba say it undermines farmer livelihood, damages non-target crops, and exacerbates the superweed problem.
Chlorine destroys the ozone layer, which protects the earth from harmful ultraviolet radiation. 2 years ago, scientists discovered that chlorine-containing compounds called chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, used as aerosols, created an ozone hole, and the response was swift. A worldwide agreement was made to end the use of CFCs. The ozone hole began to shrink. However, scientists just discovered that another chlorinated chemical, dichloromethane, used as a substitute for CFCs, is damaging the ozone layer and retarding its recovery. Their study, reported in the journal Nature Communications, found that the level of dichloromethane in the atmosphere rose by 8% a year between 2004 and 2014. Unlike CFCs, dichloromethane breaks down fairly rapidly in the atmosphere. The chemical's brief lifespan means that decreasing its emissions would have rapid benefits. As one of the scientists said, if policies were instituted to limit production of dichloromethane, the gas could be flushed out of the atmosphere relatively quickly.
Finally, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is an area so low in oxygen that most marine life must leave or suffocate. This year, the dead zone will be twice its average size and the third largest ever, over 10,000 square miles, or about the size of Vermont or New Jersey. The main cause of the dead zone is runoff of nitrogen and phosphorus from fertilizers and pesticides used in industrial agricultural fields. The dead zone is located off the coasts of Texas and Louisiana. Dead zones occur naturally in coastal waters the world over, but human activity worsens them. The case of the Gulf in the spring and summer, agriculture runoff enters the rivers in the Mississippi watershed and finds its way into the Gulf. The nitrogen and phosphorus cause massive algae blooms, which the water warms. The algae die and fall to the bottom, and their decomposition uses up oxygen in the water. And that's the news for this week. For Eco Report on WFHB, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Juliana Daly. We love to hear from our listeners. Contact us about stories we've aired, or if you have ideas for future stories. Please send emails to earth@wfhb.org.
Today's Eco Report feature, we hear part two of correspondent Bob Kissel's report from Ecuador. Kissel visited the country on a two-week birdwatching tour, and he interviewed his guide, Willie Perez.
Guide Willie Perez, we talked about the role in ecotourism for many of the native tribes in Ecuador.
Your country has a number of indigenous tribes. Are there some of the tribes who are participating in ecotourism, given that they live in very remote areas with birds that people generally may never see?
We have several ethnic groups. Some of them, especially these Guarani clans, you know, that they decided not to be in contact with the Western world, they are still untouched, I would say. But there are a lot of communities, you know, a lot of indigenous people who decided to join some ecotourism projects. And one of them is the Napo Wildlife Center, it's called, which is owned right now 100% by a local community called Anyango. And these guys, you know, they have this stunning lodge, and they make good income, and it's run by the community. There is another small lodge called Shiripuno, which is in the Asuni National Park in the Waurani territory. They are also involved in tourism. It's run by a gentleman called Harold Vaca, but the community is also involved. You know, they work there. There is another lodge called Sani, which is with the Quechua people. The lodge is owned and run by a community. So there are a lot of communities who are involved in ecotourism now. definitely they are, but there are few people who actually don't want to be involved, mm-hmm. you know, and they have been a kind of strong saying, can you leave us just how we are? So yeah, they are getting involved, you know, and obviously it's a process, it's a change, and I think eventually they will change, like what happened in many places. But so far, I think some of them, they don't want to do it yet.
One of the days you mentioned the Chocobayo territory that stretches from Central America into Ecuador.
The Chocobayo region.
Chocobayo. And can you talk about how that was and how it is now?
The Chocobayo region is a very unique hotspot for biodiversity. Basically, it starts, you know, from the Darien, I mean, South Panama, and all the western side of Colombia, and basically ends on the equator, on the western side of Ecuador. This place is very unique for, first of all, for number of species, but also for endemism. The reason why it is so high for these endemic species, because there is a lot of rain and a lot of moisture, and humidity and heat and all of that. So until now, obviously, it's considered one of the 10 hotspots for biodiversity in the world. But in Ecuador, unfortunately, as far as I know, it's something like 3% of the forest is left, the Choco forest. So during this visit, we have been actually going to Silanche, where we went, is one of the remnants of the Choco bioregion. But actually, that's an island of forests. There are some small reserves, small places that are trying to protect, but most of the forest, the Choco forest in Ecuador, is gone. Most of the problem has been logging, and also oil palm growth is everywhere.
What's the future for Ecuador's biotourism and ecotourism working hand in hand to preserve and enhance what you have, which is spectacular?
Everything is run by politics, and I don't want to start this, you know, in politics, but it will be great if the government will get more involved, you know, doing promotion and all of that. But what I see is that we have a big potential still. We are recognized as a country, as a mega diverse. The biodiversity of species in general, like plants, mammals, birds, insects, is so big. And every time we are creating more facilities. So there are better places to stay. There are more facilities to organize transport. Roads are in better conditions, and that's something good that the government has done. So people can move faster to different locations. There are more flights that has different connections to different places. What I see is that also people get more involved in tourism. There are more guides. I would say there are better guides now than it used to be. Also because media, all the technology and things like that is helping to develop this kind of, I would say, free promotion. If we keep the country developing in that kind of way, with being careful with what we do, not trying to damage or spoil it, I think we still have a big potential to make tourism or ecotourism one of the main incomes, maybe the first or the second for the country. As I said, I guide in different countries, and Ecuador maybe is one of the easiest one to guide because there are facilities mm-hmm. for birding. Lodges like the one that we are staying, we can get breakfast at any time, which is
early.
You don't get it. When I go to Argentina, no one wants to give breakfast, you know, at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, because they are not accustomed to this kind of tourism. But in Ecuador, there is a market, there are a lot of birding companies bring people, and also young students from universities, they come and stay in places like this. So it's opening more, and now with all these, as I said, free advertising, you like pictures being sent in a second to friends and family all over the world, it seems that's growing.
What are some of your favorite places in Ecuador?
There are so many places, you know, I love to go. I will say for birding, the place that I love is the western side of Pichincha province, which is where we are now. And one of the reasons is because I grew up there, but also is especially here, you know, the altitude where we are, which is around 1,300 meters. The temperature is so nice. It's kind of, it's not so hot, it's not too cold. Birds are everywhere, frogs calling, nature is wonderful. There are so many choices for accommodation. You can go from $10 to $150, $200 a night. Mm-hmm. So the choices are better. But also as a bioregion, as a diverse place, is my favorite. And another one will be the Amazon Basin. And the reason why is because I work in this lodge in Kapawi for 4 years. And I fell in love with the culture because we used to work together with an ethnic group called the Achuars, which is a very unique ethnic group. But also the biodiversity was so big, with monkeys and tapirs and pink dolphins. I love to go back. I would say between the cloud forest in this area, you know, like Mindo area and Makipukuna, and the rainforest on the east are my favorite places.
Okay. For WFHB, this has been Bob Kissel reporting from high in the Andes Mountains of Ecuador.
Seeking volunteer journalists to contribute short weekly headlines about ecological issues from indigenous resistance to infrastructure projects to climate change and biological diversity. Commitment is light and you can set your own schedule. For more information, email us at earth@wfhb.org or call 812-323-1200. It's time now for In Nature, a segment focusing on the flora and fauna of South Central Indiana.
This is In Nature.
Ringneck snakes, Diadophis punctatus, are small snakes from 10 to 12 inches long, found in the moist woods of this region. They are secretive, nocturnal species that live on lizards, amphibian slugs, and other small creatures. Their top is light brown to black, with a bright yellow band around their neck. Their underbelly is also bright yellow. Ringneck snakes are not aggressive. Though they use venom on their prey, they are not known to bite large predators. Their reaction to disturbance is to curl their tail tightly, exposing the yellow coloration on their belly. These snakes capture their prey by striking and then constricting. Once the snake has secured its prey, it uses its back teeth to inject the animal with a venom produced by a gland behind the snake's eyes. Ringneck snakes mate in spring. Males are attracted to pheromones secreted by the female. A male snake rubs his closed mouth along the female's body, then bites her ring and maneuvers himself so that he can insert sperm into her vent. The female then lays 3 to 10 eggs in a moist, aerated soil under rotted logs or stones. Eggs are laid in early summer and hatch in August or September. Large numbers of these snakes hibernate together in a deep hole or under rotted wood. During hot weather, they make holes or burrow under logs.
You've been listening to In Nature.
And now for our weekly events calendar. There will be a full moon hike at Spring Mill State Park on Saturday, July 8th from 9 to 10:30 p.m. Hike by the light of the full moon around Spring Mill Lake. Meet at the Lakeview Activity Center for this moderate one-mile hike.
The Homegrown Indiana Farm Tour will take place on Sunday, July 9th from 4 to 8:30 p.m. Tour Blue Hour Farm, a 3.3-acre organic farm on the southwest side of Bloomington, followed by a tour of Marble Hill Farm, which has over 200 animals, including Angus cattle, Shetland sheep, poultry, horses, donkeys, and waterfowl. The evening culminates with a dinner prepared by local chefs, including vegetarian and vegan options. This is a farm-to-fork experience you will not want to miss. The bus departs from City Hall at 4:15 p.m. For more information and to register for this ticketed event, visit bloomington.in.gov/farmersmarket.
Enjoy an Urban Boots hike with instructor Becky Janaya down the Beeline Trail to explore nature in the heart of downtown Bloomington on Saturday, July 9th from 9 to 10 a.m. Walk. While you're on the walk, you will identify trees, spot evidence of animals, and listen for birds. Meet on the steps of City Hall for this walk before you begin your farmers market shopping. Register by July 9th at bloomington.in.gov/parks.
Take an edible plants hike at the Paintown State Recreation Area at Monroe Lake on Friday, July 14th from 8 to 8:45 p.m. Do you want to learn how to integrate some common wild edible plants into your diet? Join this hike to identify and sample several wild plants. Meet at the campground playground.
Amy Greeley, the artist in residence at Brown County State Park, will present Forest Understory on Saturday, July 15th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., which will include a workshop and a hike. You will explore the often overlooked understory of the forest floor. Lichen, fungus, ferns, and wildflowers will be observed on the trails and will serve as inspiration for a series of wearable art pieces to be created and shared with the public by hands-on demonstrations. Meet at the Brown County State Park Nature Center to participate.
That wraps up our show for this week. Eco Report is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This week's news stories were written by Ashley Curtis, Cole Stinson, Linda Green, and Norm Holey. The feature was produced by Bob Kissel. Rebecca Mueller edited the script, and myself, Juliana Daly, compiled our events calendar. Our engineer is Sarah Vaughn. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Juliana Daly.
And I'm David Lyman. Join us on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. before Democracy Now! And on Fridays at 5 p.m. before Kiteline for our weekly radio rundown of ecological news and resistance. Until then, Eco Report encourages you to take direct action to defend the Earth.
You've been listening to the Eco Report,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
Eco Report is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana.
Bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the Eco Report staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.